Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the issue of sexual harassment that is now migrating from Roy Moore's past in Alabama back to the occupant in the Oval Office's past, with 56 female members of Congress asking the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform's chairman to investigate charges by at least 17 women who claim they were sexually assaulted or harassed by Donald Trump. Christina Giorgio, an attorney in Manhattan who represents employees in workplace discrimination and sexual harassment disputes, joins us to discuss Trump's response to a call for his resignation from Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who he then smeared, implying that she was willing to trade sex for a campaign contribution from him. Since Christina represents a wide range of clients, we will explore the broader landscape of what women have to deal with in the workplace, in corporate America, government jobs, and small businesses, not to mention waitresses and barmaids, and assess what kind of changes in the law and in our culture are necessary to achieve dignity, safety, and equality in the workplace. Then, with the polls having just closed in Alabama in what is expected to be a close race, we will speak with Mark Denbow, a professor of law at Seton Hall's School of Law, who as a young college student 52 years ago joined the March for Civil Rights in Selma, Alabama, and in 2015 returned to Selma for the commemoration of the 1965 Bloody Sunday. We will discuss how much Roy Moore is a throwback to the days of George Wallace, but given the terror and brutality that Mark and the other marchers endured back then, even Moore's election will not turn back the clock to when African Americans had no rights and were lynched with impunity. Then finally, we will examine the latest annual Arctic Report Card for 2017 with its author, Jeremy Mathis, the director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's NOAA's Arctic Research Program. He joins us to discuss the unprecedented record rate at which the Arctic ice cap is melting, the fastest decline in Arctic sea ice in at least 1,500 years, thus reducing the amount of light reflected back into space, trapping heat, which adds to global warming as the melting ice causes sea levels to rise. And joining us now is Christina Giorgio, who's a managing attorney of Derrick Smith Law Group's Manhattan office, where she focuses on representing employees in workplace discrimination and sexual harassment disputes. She started her legal career as a union-side labor lawyer in Chicago and has sued some of the world's largest corporations over their unjust and unlawful employment practices. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christina Giorgio.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you for joining us, and your senator, the New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who called upon Donald Trump to resign after several women had asked Congress to investigate their stories. All told, there are 19 accusers of Donald Trump. But in response, Donald Trump attacked Kirsten Gillibrand as a total flunky and went on to suggest that she begged him for campaign donations in the past and would do anything for them, a clear smear in the sense that he's more or less implying that she's prostituted, would prostitute herself, or in fact may well have tried to prostitute herself in front of him to get campaign money. In other words, she's willing to trade sex for campaign contributions. That's pretty outrageous, don't you think?
Well, it's very outrageous. I mean, that's absolutely what he was implying. When I heard that, I thought, oh my gosh, here goes Donald Trump yet again, you know, attacking people when they're raising very, very serious matters and doing it in the most outrageous fashion possible.
And, of course, the 56 members of the Democratic Women's Working Group in Congress have asked the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, chaired by Trey Gowdy, to look into the issue of all of these women making complaints against Donald Trump. Of course, Trey Gowdy being famous for the Benghazi inquiry, I'm not holding my breath. How about you?
Oh, no. I don't think we would have long on this earth if we were holding our breath for that, Ian.
So let's turn to the work that you do, because my understanding is you take cases across a broad spectrum of working life in America for women, in not just in big corporations, but in government, state, local, federal, and small business. I imagine the area where sexual harassment is most endemic probably is, would it be with waitresses and barmaids, et cetera? I mean, where is the worst offenders?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, sadly, we can't say that this is relegated to any portion of the workforce in the United States. I have clients who are executives at elite banks. I have clients who are, you know, have PhDs working in academics. And I have women who, you know, are taking tickets at movie theaters. It's really across the board, and it's so ingrained and entrenched in our culture with respect to how many women, but how many men, of course, most men are appropriate at work, and I don't want to sound like, you know, there's not a man out there with, you know, without a clue with respect to how to treat women and their colleagues at work. But unfortunately, there is a very substantial percentage of the male workforce who does see a women showing up to work as sort of a dating system. I routinely have to prosecute cases where my clients are simply just showing up to work, and their coworkers and typically their supervisors are expecting them to date them. And if they don't, their job is in jeopardy. And, you know, it's, you know, very, very challenging for women, because there's very few people who go to work just for the fun of it. You know, we, you know, myself, I love my work, but most of us are doing it because we need to. We need to put food on the table. We need to support our families, our parents, our children, things like this. And to make dating your boss or a coworker who may be sponsored by a boss in some way, making dating this person a prerequisite to keeping your job, of course, puts you know, entire communities really in peril.
But surely the fact that your clients come to you, my sense would be that women who actually hire a lawyer to get justice would be in a minority of those that are harassed.
Well, I suppose that's true. I mean, I don't have statistics on that, but I do know that the Me Too campaign is very good evidence that this is just all too common. I certainly experienced a certain amount of sexual harassment early in my legal career, and at that time, in the early 90s, when I was in law school and finishing law school, certainly this was a time where, you know, the press was focused on Anita Hill and what was happening there. But at the time, it really did not seem reporting was even an option from a career perspective. And I hate to say it, it really hasn't changed that much. It is easier. The internet has been very helpful, a great equalizer in terms of access to legal representation. You know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, just trying to find a lawyer was much harder. You know, now there are a lot of resources out there. Women can do, you know, comparative shopping and whatnot. But in terms of the professional cost and price that women pay for reporting these things is all too high. It is a rare case where the woman is supported in the way that she really needs to be. And part of that is it's incumbent upon companies to investigate these things in an unbiased way. But oftentimes the unbiased approach ends up victimizing and penalizing the woman who came forward. That's something that we see repeatedly. And it's not uncommon for women to just simply try to work within this environment in order to keep her job.
And again, I'm speaking with Christina Giorgio, who's a managing attorney of Derek Smith Law Group's Manhattan office, where she focuses on representing employees in workplace discrimination and sexual harassment disputes. She started her legal career as a union-side labor lawyer in Chicago and has sued some of the world's largest corporations over their unjust and unlawful employment practices. So are the statutes on the books then adequate? Is this a legal problem, a cultural problem, or a combination of both?
Well, it's certainly a cultural problem. We have several, you know, we have the federal statutes, and that is available to all workers across the country. And then you have states and adopting their own anti-discrimination laws, which, of course, capture sexual harassment. And then typically you have cities adopting their own. And it's not uncommon for these statutes to mirror the federal statute, but sometimes a city or a state will go farther. And some of these laws are very, very good. But the problem is that the culture is so entrenched in terms of viewing women as, of course, not every man and not every office, but there is a pervasive cultural bias towards seeing women as, sexual objects, open for dating. That's why they're there, at least in part. So we really need to see a cultural shift, and there are so many good male voices out there. With regard to Senator Franken, I think that this is a very important case for us to discuss. It's a very difficult case, and I know I was listening to your show maybe last week talking about sort of the political calculus around why the pressure, the additional pressure for him to step down, and what's happening with Roy Moore in Alabama. But this is a case where you're asking, what type of tolerance will we have when it comes down to demeaning women at work? And you have somebody like Mr. Franken, who is really a recognized voice for women. He's been an excellent senator with respect to women's rights. And yet you have him on record, at least in some instances. I certainly was not there. I can't say whether, the accusations are in fact true. But there is at least these photographs where he is engaged in behavior that, again, demeans women. And so to me, personally and professionally, when you have somebody as enlightened and as gentlemanly as Al Franken, also engaged in this type of, demeaning conduct towards women, it really shows you how pervasive the problem is, because you have, unfortunately, a lot of people who have been raised, to be less informed with respect to issues of oppression and power dynamics. So we have a real cultural problem, but I think that what's happening now and the discussion and the public attention, we will see a shift, but at the same time, I try to remind people that this was a hotly debated discussion in the early 90s with respect to Anita Hill and the Supreme Court confirmation. And it was recognized at that time that sexual harassment was a very, very deep-seated and common problem in the workplace. You have a lot of important Supreme Court decisions coming out with respect to how we define sexual harassment. For a long time, it's been recognized as a deep problem in our workforce. It hasn't changed. It's not going away. I mean, I think that from a legal perspective and what we're going to see happen with our caseload is that, of course, we're going to see, I'm sure, a level of uptake with more women coming forward. They're being educated as to what is actionable, what is not actionable. But my hope is that employers will take this as an educational opportunity to really make the changes that they need to make within their corporate offices to ensure that there's just zero tolerance for a hostile work environment with respect to any type of unlawful discrimination, but particularly with respect to sexual harassment, because the power dynamic between men and women is very unequal. Women still have a long way to go before they are on par with men with respect to their positions of power. And until we get there, corporations and employers need to do more to make sure that these policies that they may have in place, it's not lip service, that there's really meaningful training and meaningful opportunity to report things and to report it in a safe way so that people don't feel that they're going to lose their jobs.
But in terms of the law and statute, is it a case, though, that the sort of corporatization of the law in a way, for example, with class actions becoming less and less available to citizens and more people in the corporate world are being forced into arbitration. Does that also apply to HR, human resources in corporate America, where I understand the expectation is that if you're being harassed and you're a woman in the workplace in corporate America, then you can go to HR. And if you don't go to HR, then that's kind of held against you, even if you think it's worthless going to them in the first place.
Well, sure. Well, you mentioned arbitration, and this is a growing, what can I say, it's certainly a trend, and it's very problematic from an employment standpoint because, you know, people are accepting jobs, and from day one, they're signing away their federal rights, their state rights, to be in court to resolve any disputes they have with their employer as it relates to discrimination. It's a very unfortunate trend. But with respect to how the law, in some ways, I don't want to say insulates employers, but it certainly allows employers an opportunity to defend themselves, even if there's a very hostile work environment, which they have not done enough to address. There is something called a Fair-Ellerth defense, and when a corporation has taken upon themselves to institute sexual harassment policies so that they make it clear that, you know, they don't tolerate it and that every employer has an opportunity to report these things, when they have that program in place and an employee fails to take advantage of it in certain instances, and I'm sort of oversimplifying it, but in certain instances, that is a way for employers to say, no, you know, there's not liability here because this particular individual didn't take advantage of these programs. So there is, you know, clearly a corporate bias developing in the American jurisprudence for quite some time. I think with respect to sexual harassment, the laws are actually, they're quite good, and we have some very good case law. You know, sexual harassment, when lawmakers and judges are faced with it, you know, they get it. They get that this is just fundamentally unfair. But the problem is that, one of the problems is that you have so much of it occurring in private, where bosses typically wait to be alone with their subordinate. And so it is very common. We see it over and over again that harassers, men, sometimes women, but men who do engage in this type of unlawful conduct at work, they're crafty, they're smart about it, and they wait till they're alone with the person who they've decided to pressure for, you know, sexual favors or just to be inappropriate around. So it can become very difficult for the person who's been victimized in this way to actually support her case because it becomes a he said, she said situation. And, you know, when you're prosecuting a case, the person bringing the charges has the burden. You know, I always tell my clients, you know, when we're going forward, our case must be better than the defendant's case, right? And so when you have this he said, she said, it can become very difficult. And over and over and over again, I see these supervisors waiting till the person's alone, and then it becomes very difficult. You know, I know we don't have a lot of time. I do want to mention one thing with respect to the confidentiality agreements. I know that there's been a lot of discussion around the problems with confidentiality agreements, and we see them all the time. Prosecuting these cases, very difficult. I mean, they're very embarrassing. They're very demoralizing to have to talk about graphic things. And people understandably want to settle before it becomes a public matter. Or even after they've filed their suit, they want to be spared the trauma of having to be deposed with respect to these very, very sensitive matters. And the confidentiality agreement is something we see all the time. And I think that we're going to see more and more pushback on these confidentiality agreements. And I think that's going to be a real breakthrough because up until recently, there's a real culture of silence and gagging, like gag orders, around discussing who is doing the harassing. And with regard to the tax bill, there are some changes proposed there relating to the deductibility of your attorney's expenses when it comes down to defending sexual harassment claims. One of the things in the tax bill, basically, it says, if there's a confidentiality agreement in place with respect to settling a sexual harassment claim, you will not be able to deduct the settlement amount as a business expense. That's a very, I mean, I'm not sure if that's going to survive, but I think that that's going to be a very good thing. I'm not a supporter at all of this bill, but that did catch my attention, that could be, we could see some significant changes because corporations are very motivated to have everything hush up, hushed up, not discussed, and so we won't be embarrassed. But, you know, these corporations are very much motivated by their bottom line. And up until now, it just hasn't been hitting their bottom line hard enough for them to make the hard decisions to make cultural changes within their offices.
Well, just in closing then, where is the battlefield? I mean, the day after Donald Trump's inauguration, there was a spontaneous gathering of millions of women around the country and around the world, for that matter. And it was spontaneous, and one got the definite impression that women are becoming more of a political force, and we'll see what happens in Alabama tonight. But in general, there's a sense of women asserting themselves politically. But we also, early in the conversation, you know, mentioned that this is as much a cultural problem as a political problem. Does that mean that women have to fight on two fronts, or how do you see this battle going forward?
Well, like I said, I do see this as an opportunity for employers to get real with being serious in making sure that this type of hostile work environment or quid pro quo, which is basically a type of sexual harassment where your boss is requiring sexual favors to keep, you know, in order to allow you to keep your job. I think that this is a teachable moment for corporate America, in part because they're realizing how expensive this could be for them. But in terms of where the battleground is, it's very intoxicating to watch women support each other as they have been supporting each other over the last several months, very publicly. Again, these are very difficult things to talk about, but the sheer numbers, you know, you can no longer pretend that this is just a one-off event. There's a real demand for cultural change, and women, I think, are now given the platform to discuss these things, knowing that it's safe to come forward. I have many clients, you know, who of course came forward before the spotlight, and they came forward when it wasn't safe. And it's not like it's still entirely safe for women, but women are more likely to be believed now, and that is a very significant cultural shift. But at the same time, we can't let this moment pass. We have to keep pushing forward and trying to, of course, change laws where there are weaknesses. I mean, certainly on the Hill, the opportunities for sexual harassment and non-accountability is an outlier. I mean, you have these people in Congress who really get to end run the sexual harassment laws that other employers have to face. And I think that there needs to be changes in Washington, and of course, with respect to the president, where he can brag about groping the private parts of women and seeing that as one of his fine attributes. This needs to be deemed as utterly unacceptable, and I don't think that the pressure on Donald Trump should retreat. I think that these women are absolutely right to push forward on that, because it's the president who largely sets the tone for what's acceptable culturally, and the tone he's set is so unacceptable that it is very grateful to these women for coming forward.
Well, Christina Georgiou, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Christina Georgiou, who's the managing attorney of Derrick Smith Law Group's Manhattan office, where she focuses on representing employees in workplace discrimination and sexual harassment disputes. She started her legal career as a union-side labor lawyer in Chicago and has sued some of the world's largest corporations over their unjust and unlawful employment practices. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the results from the race in Alabama with someone who marched in Selma 52 years ago.
spare change. You got to feel strange. And now...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mark Dembo, who's a professor of law at Seton Hall School of Law and the director of the Seton Hall Law School's Center for Policy and Research. As a young college student 50 years ago, Professor Dembo joined the March for Civil Rights in Selma, Alabama, and in 2015 he returned to Selma for the commemoration of the 1965 Bloody Sunday. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Dembo.
Thank you.
And it seems that Roy Moore is a relic from the Old South. When, after all of these charges from young women in Alabama emerged, his first appearance was at a church where he dismissed all the charges as being a hit job by the Democrats, and then said, I really want to talk about important issues, and then said in 1963 the Supreme Court outlawed prayer in school, and in 1965 they gave away special rights, implying that the 1965 Voting Rights Act was somehow special rights for African Americans. And then more recently, we learned that he, in response to a question from the only African American in the audience, asked about what was a good time in America, and he said, in the days of slavery, families were much more together. An extraordinarily, to my mind, indication that this man is an unreconstructed racist. You've been on the front line with the civil rights movement. How does he strike you?
Well, and he certainly is an unreconstructed racist, and George Wallace would understand him very well, and so would Sheriff Clark. In fact, one of the things that I think stings me a little bit is that so many of his really horrific social positions that ought to disqualify him have gotten buried by the sexual disgraces that he's also perpetrated. But it seems to me that the people of Alabama and the people of America need to take into account the man that who he is based on his entire life. And I think it also has to be juxtaposed with the Democratic candidate, Doug Jones. One of the really moving, uplifting moments for me after decades going back in the South was when Jones actually prosecuted the two Ku Klux Klan members that were surviving for blowing up the 16th Street Baptist Church. Now, my father was a minister, and he was a combat chaplain with Patton during World War II. He was in with the Third Army from D-Day all the way through the Battle of the Bulge and everything through until May when Germany surrendered. And my father always told me, and I remember it because it's so pointed at this moment. My dad always said there were two things that he thought were sacred about America, both of which actually are enshrined in the First Amendment, not that he was a lawyer. One was the idea of freedom of religion, which included being safe in churches to worship, and the other was the right to vote. And, of course, my father would sit there, and he was well aware of the 16th Street Baptist Church being blown up, and it was an incredibly painful feeling for him to look and see those four black children who were murdered and all the others who died. And all of that was really resisting voting rights. Not everybody remembers, but the March on Washington, which was this incredibly happy, loving event in a warm, hot summer day in Washington with 100,000 people of all kinds sharing and feeling positive and good, 3 weeks later, they blew up the Baptist Church. And it was clearly a reaction to almost the warm, good feeling and fellowship that the various constituencies felt working together. So I've always associated the March on Washington as a provocative act in the eyes of the Ku Klux Klan members and the Southern racists. And that was a factor in why when Martin Luther King asked people to come down to protect the marchers in Selma, that people came. And the feeling was that the right to vote was so crucial and that that was the only way we were ever going to protect people and protect people to be free to pray in safety in their sanctuaries was going to be the Voting Rights Act. And now I'm observing with dismay not only that the unregenerate racists such as former Judge Moore, but Sheriff Jim Clark and all of the others look back on this period of time as the time when they heroically fought for the right to kill people in churches and to deny people the right to vote. And it's very painful. I'm 75 years old now. And I thought when Lyndon Johnson got the Voting Rights Act passed in 1965, really was going to be a new day. And it seemed like it was. And I don't want to overstate it. It's a new day in many parts of the country and in many parts of the South, but not all parts. And even in the more benign ones, there's still the same anger and the same racial hatred from far too many people.
But the possibility that Roy Moore could be elected in Alabama means that there are enough people down there that would vote for him. And my understanding is that amongst the Roy Moore supporters, the buzzword for Democrat is actually black. They don't see it as a Democratic Party. They just see it as that's the black party. That's the party of the blacks. And the fake media, the dishonest media, the crooked media that Donald Trump refers to all the time, which they also believe, that's code word for New York Jews. They control the media in the eyes of these people. And of course, the proof is in the pudding based upon what Roy Moore's wife said last night at a rally, where she talked about how they knew Jews and then faced the press and gestured to the press in the back and said, and of course you, meaning you Jews in the press, absolutely amazing. Let's play that clip.
Fake news would tell you that we don't care for Jews. I tell you all this because I've seen it all, so I just want to set the record straight while they're here. One of our attorneys is a Jew. We have very close friends that are Jewish and rabbis, and we also fellowship with them.
Well, there you have it. I don't know what to say. So, to my mind, this is a bigger problem than Roy Moore, surely. This is about not just Roy Moore being an unreconstructed racist, but the people who vote for him are also in that bag, too.
Oh, I think he typifies the entire hostility to the reforms, voting reforms, civil rights reforms, resistance to anti-Semitism, all of those things that took place after World War II and after 1965. Clearly, he just typifies it. I think it's important to keep in mind that the real danger is how many people support him. He doesn't matter. He's just sort of an ignorant, mean old man. But the fact of the matter is that it's the people who use him and others as a way to try to take back the country that they liked when, as he pointed out, slavery was in place and white families were held together so well. No, I think the problem is that if he wins, it's another sign that the rage is of sort of ignorant people is growing. I sometimes speculate that this has a lot to do with the fact that we've had a successful black president for 8 years. That to some extent, some of those same people, and I've heard them, view when Obama got elected, when President Obama was elected, that it was as if now the blacks were taking over and getting their fair share. And I do wonder if the rage and the anti-race, the anti-black attitude might be quite different if we hadn't had a very successful, moderate, thoughtful, and well-regarded black president. I hate to think that, because some of my friends called me in 2008 on election night, people I hadn't spoken to since 1965, 66, 67, and it was a tearful conversation in which we believed that this was the fulfillment of a lot of effort And, you know, it's an especially poignant thing. You spend your whole life dealing with something and you actually feel a major social reform is accomplished and locked into place. And within 8 years, those people who you would have thought had accepted it and seen the value and the appreciation of it are really quite ruthlessly and deliberately taking it back. And by the way, it's not just Alabama. Look at all the states that are trying to take the right to vote away. I mean, it's clear that voting is the threat to a constituency that does not reflect what we all grew up hoping we were, and I still expect us to become. But it's a scary time right now.
Well, but when you put it in that light, it's really a referendum on America. I know that Trump is pulling out all the stops because it's sort of his Waterloo. If he loses, it's going to signal all he cares about is winning at all costs. It doesn't matter. There's no principle obviously involved here except his own political survival and his own illusions about himself. But I think the rest of the world is looking askance at this and thinking, my God, are they going to actually elect a child molester in the United States to the United States Senate? I mean, that's where I don't understand how the mental gymnastics of those so-called Christians in the South, the Christian Zionists in particular, how could you stray that far from who the prophet Jesus was and what he stood for and what his sacrifices meant? I mean, that's the part that I don't understand. And I don't understand why real Christians somehow can't transcend this abomination and this heresy. What's the problem?
I understand your point. Look, I'm a Christian, the son of a minister. I understand that, and it is quite distressing. It is true that we have always had cycles of sort of a religious fervor and intensity that fades, often in crazy ways, when people are going to mountaintops and selling their properties, and that's happened in the United States. And I think in some ways you could look and say there's something happening in the world as well. There's religious fundamentalism and craziness all throughout the world, and it is driven and reflected in some of these terrorist acts. I think it's kind of ironic that some of the so-called Christians who are espousing the positions you're talking about are actually playing a certain role in the Christian religion that these fundamentalist and very hostile Muslims are feeling and have been striking out that way. So I'm not sure that there's that much difference in terms of religious anger and hostility. It seems like sometimes it comes in cycles. And so I'm depressed by it, but I also believe that we've overcome things like this before.
But
Shall overcome. How about that?
You can say that, and indeed at the CIA headquarters, there's the Gospel of St. John, the truth, ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make ye free. That is a concept, too, that goes back to the Enlightenment of the 18th century. That's not working anymore because you've got Trump and Fox News and all this fake reality where they branded reality as a lie and they propagate lies which, you know, 40% of the country believes. So you've got fake religion and fake news. That's two very hard battles to win, and I'm not sure how you reverse that trend.
Well, we will. We've done it before. Let me tell you, 1965 is a lot uglier when you're down there now with the sheriffs and the governors, law enforcement, the Ku Klux Klan, beating up and killing many blacks, children, women, and others, and getting acquitted for doing so. And that seemed incredibly grim. I don't want to sound like I'm being optimistic about where we are now because it's terrifying and scary. But this country has overcome its ugliness and gotten better. And then we slip back and we try to keep rising up. And, you know, I do think the arc, you know, the moral universe swings toward justice. And I think it does do that, although perhaps it's not a smooth swing and it's lurching. Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with anything you said about where we are now. I probably most strongly resist the idea that perhaps somehow or other we are not going to be able to recover from this because we've done it before. You know, nothing I've seen so far is scarier than what people did in the South in the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s. That was scary. And they murdered people when we were before we got there, when we were there, and afterwards. And but somehow, as Lyndon Johnson said in 1965 to the entire Congress, we shall overcome. And he got the Voting Rights Act through. So I'm resisting the sort of despairing quality. And I think it'd be better for us to be angry and effectively preparing and taking steps to correct it. We've done it before, and we can do it again. And if I don't make it to do it, my children and grandchildren can. Everybody's children and grandchildren can do this.
Well, you know, if you look at history, all of the great social change and improvements in this country were made by, largely by religiously motivated people. The end of slavery, the end of child labor, civil rights, human rights, women's rights.
In Selma, the overwhelming number of marchers, other than the incredibly brave high school kids and the farmers in the area, were clergy.
Mm-hmm.
You saw collars of Protestants and Catholics. You saw yarmulkes. There were priests, rabbis marching. And you could fairly say that that was a shining moment when religion and social movements came together. And I think you are right when you say that we have to look much more towards the Catholic and the Christian church and the Jewish rabbis and so forth and synagogues to come forward again. But the only thing I'm telling you is I believe they will.
Right.
And I think it's your show and our job to keep making people be ready for it. And when they are, you know, I only say that because when I went to Selma, I went for no heroic reason. It was the right thing to do. And so did everybody else who went down there. And I think we might not have thought it was the right thing to do 10 years earlier, but somehow that was the moment. And I think those moments will continue to come. And I think we can hope that today's election, there will be the beginning of one of those moments. But as I don't want to invest all my hopes in one event, and it would certainly be ironic for me if Alabama turned out to inspire hope and optimism for the future, because I don't have especially good memories about Alabama. I've been told by my daughter I shouldn't be so angry, but they killed people and got away with it.
Well, Mark Denbow, I thank you very much for joining us. I really very much appreciate this conversation.
Okay.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Denbow. He's a professor of law at Seton Hall School of Law and the director of the Seton Hall Law School Center for Policy and Research. As a young college student 50 years ago, Professor Denbow joined the March for Civil Rights in Selma, Alabama. And in 2015, he returned to Selma for the commemoration of the 1965 Bloody Sunday. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the author of the Arctic Report Card for 2017, which finds that the Arctic ice cap is melting at the fastest decline in 1,500 years.
Southern man, better keep your head. VIP. Let's kick it. Ice, ice, baby. Ice, ice, baby. All right, stop. Collaborate and listen. Ice is back with my brand new invention. Something grabs a hold of me tightly. Flow like a harpoon daily and nightly. Will it ever stop? Yo, I don't know.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, Jeremy Mathis, who's the director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's NOAA's Arctic Research Program in Washington, D.C., and the co-author of their 2017 Arctic Report Card. He's also an adjunct faculty member at Georgetown University and has published more than 80 peer-reviewed articles on the Arctic and climate change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeremy Mathis.
Thank you very much for having me.
And the latest Arctic report card that was released today, which you are the chief author of, it's an annual report. It's pretty grim. I mean, last year was the warmest year on record, but this year is almost as bad, right?
Well, that's right. This year was the second warmest year on record. 2016 was an extraordinary year for the warming that we observed in the Arctic. The temperatures came down a bit in 2017, but we're still seeing that the Arctic is on this very precipitous trend towards being a different environment now and into the future than anything we've seen in at least the last 1,500 years and probably going back far longer than that. The warming temperatures, the loss of sea ice, and the changes in the landscape are truly extraordinary right now.
But the main issue, surely, is that it's shrinking, right? Because my understanding is that one of the causes of global warming is that heat gets trapped in the atmosphere that would normally be reflected back into outer space. The white surface of the polar ice caps reflect the light back. If that area, that mass of white, is reduced, it's replaced by the dark ocean, which doesn't reflect back, and therefore that is the cycle we're on. Is that an adequate description?
That is absolutely correct. I refer to it as the darkening of the Arctic. Two decades ago, the Arctic was still a very white place. It had very white sea ice. It was filled with white snow and white glaciers. And those white surfaces reflected the majority of sunlight back into space. The Arctic acted like a refrigerator for the planet because it didn't trap the heat coming in from outer space. Now, as the ice has melted, the snow has melted, and the glaciers have melted, it's replaced that white surface with a very dark surface, whether it is in the ocean or on land. And now, instead of reflecting that heat back into space, the Arctic is absorbing the heat. And so it's like we've left the door open on our refrigerator, and it simply can't keep up with the cooling that we need it to do in order for the global climate to continue to function the way that it should and the way that it anticipated and the way that we anticipate it doing. And because of that warming, because the Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet, it is beginning to cause some disruptions in weather events throughout the Northern Hemisphere, whether it's over North America or over into Europe and Asia. We are seeing our first indications that what happens in the Arctic from a warming and atmospheric change standpoint is propagating out into other parts outside of the Arctic.
But surely as the polar ice caps melt, that water goes into the ocean, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and that's another big thing that we are really concerned about when it comes to the Arctic. And I think that melting of the Greenland ice sheet and melting of Arctic glaciers is the one area where most people on the planet are going to be impacted, because as that ice melts and as it drains into the ocean, not only is it contributing to sea level rise, but because there has been this recent acceleration of that melting, sea level rise projections are having to be updated to show that there's going to be honestly more of an increase over the next 50 to 100 years. So that's the biggest wild card that we're dealing with in the Arctic right now, is because it is warming at such an extraordinary pace, we're having to update nearly on an annual basis sea level rise projections because of the melting, particularly of the Greenland ice sheet.
And how much is this cycle self-reinforcing? In other words, I don't know that there's an end in sight here. Certainly, the trends would indicate it's just going to continue. But doesn't it do things, for example, when the permafrost in the Arctic melts, that releases methane, which is about the worst global warming gas there is, and that in turn exacerbates the problem. So are we not on a cycle where the amount of the reduction of the ice caps and the increase in sea level will continue to rise?
Yes, and that's two topics there, and I think we need to take both of them one at a time. On the one hand, the warming is causing the permafrost to thaw, and that thawing of the permafrost can release more carbon dioxide and more methane into the atmosphere that leads to more warming, that leads to more thawing of permafrost. The second part of that question is whether it's self-reinforcing, and it absolutely is. The more ice that melts, the more heat is absorbed. The more heat is absorbed, the more ice melts, and so it creates a cascading impact. And now it's like a train that's going down the track at 100 miles an hour. It's very hard to stop that train once it's moving that quickly. And unfortunately, the Arctic now has a tremendous amount of momentum when it comes to a changing environment. And so even if we stopped emitting carbon dioxide tomorrow, the atmosphere would continue to warm and the Arctic would continue to have this amplification effect because of the melting of these white surfaces. So unfortunately, regardless of what we do at this point, the Arctic is going to be a very different place a decade from now compared to what it was a decade ago. So with that in mind, we have to start getting ourselves ready to deal with that new Arctic environment, dealing with a new Arctic Ocean that's going to be largely open during the summertime, of dealing with warmer temperatures and of dealing with melting ice off the land masses that are contributing to sea level rise. So we can certainly handle those problems. There are solutions and there are things that we can do, but we sure have to create some recognition to everyone across the United States and really across the world that these changes that are happening in the Arctic and the challenges that they're going to bring are going to be a global problem that everybody is going to have to deal with sooner or later.
And again, excuse me. And again, I'm speaking with Jeremy Mathis, who's the director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA's Arctic Research Program in Washington, D.C., and co-author of their 2017 Arctic Report Card. He's also an adjunct faculty member at Georgetown University and has published more than 80 peer-reviewed articles on the Arctic and climate change. But when you say we have to get used to an Arctic that has changed, that in the summer it'll be opened up, and a lot of people are seeing that as virtuous. Vladimir Putin's excited about the idea of extracting oil from the Arctic and creating shipping lanes, and there's juggling going on between Canada, the U.S., China, and Russia over the future of the Arctic in terms of commercial trade routes, etc., and resources, minerals, and oil. But at the same time, the ocean will be gradually rising. So when is that going to get our attention? When is the people just going to notice that the ocean is rising? I mean, people in these small Pacific islands know about it. These islands are disappearing. But when will the average American have this in their face?
Well, I sure hope they start noticing it right now today, if they didn't start noticing it yesterday. You know, I'm down here in New Orleans this week for the American Geophysical Union meeting where we released the Arctic Report Card, and Louisiana is going to really have to deal with rising sea levels over the next few decades. And we're already seeing evidence of sea level rise and the impact that's having in low-lying areas in states like Louisiana. So this isn't some far-off problem that's going to be a challenge 100 years from now. This is an issue right now, today. If you're living along the coast, you're already dealing with sea level rise to a certain extent, and that's exacerbated when storm systems, particularly hurricanes, come on shore. The rise in sea level that's happened over the past few years is already making storm surges worse. And that's something that any American that lives within 100 miles of the coast is going to have to deal with starting 10 years ago, but now even more as we go forward, the problem is going to continue to get worse. So That's why we want to do things like publish the Arctic Report card and why we want to get the message out that this isn't a problem that's up in some faraway place that's full of polar bears and that we don't need to think about. The Arctic is a place that is going to have disruptions for the entire population of the planet, but particularly for all Americans who are going to end up paying higher prices for food, are dealing with more extreme weather events, or even having to deal with climate refugees as people have to start relocating their homes out of areas that are being flooded from things like sea level rise.
Well, just in closing, I talked to a scientist a while ago who said that if we painted every roof white, every parking lot white, every road white, we may head in the direction of being able to reflect some of this heat back into outer space. I mean, it's better to stop what we're doing, but we're the only country in the world that's still arguing about whether what's happening is real or not, which is pretty pathetic. But if we finally come to our senses and recognize this is real, are there any mitigating solutions or... is that a practical one, for example?
Well, yes. Anything that we can do to reduce our heat effect will be a positive thing. So there are a number of mitigation efforts. Some of them are good. Some of them are still in the realm of science fiction. But there are things today that we can start doing to mitigate the impacts of the climate disruptions that we're starting to see. First and foremost, we have to get at the problem that's causing it. We have to stop emitting so much carbon dioxide. But we're clearly not going to move away from a fossil fuel-based economy anytime soon. So if we accept that and we accept the fact that we're going to have to invest some resources as a nation to put some mitigating efforts in place to help really deal with the challenges that are going to come on the horizon, then that's a step in the right direction for me. These solutions are going to cost money, and in some cases they're not going to be easy, but they're better than waiting for your entire neighborhood to be burned down during a December wildfire season unlike anything we've ever seen before in California. So the choice to me is pretty clear. We can either invest in impact mitigation, or we can wait until the impacts are so extraordinary that we go bankrupt from having to deal with them. And that's true whether it's Hurricane Harvey hitting Houston and the Gulf of Mexico, or whether it's wildfires burning large parts of California. There are things that we can do now to mitigate a lot of those major impacts that we've seen this year. We just have to have the willingness to do that.
Well, Jeremy Mathis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure. Good luck.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jeremy Mathis, who's the director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA's Arctic Research Program in Washington, D.C., and the co-author of their 2017 Arctic Report Card. He's also an adjunct faculty member at Georgetown University and has published more than 80 peer-reviewed articles on the Arctic and climate change. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.